Welcome to Quinn's Empowerment Hour on the BBS Radio Network, hosted by Quinn Lay Erickson, psychotherapist, life coach, and inspirational speaker. Quinn's experience as a blind woman, a boat person from Vietnam, and a refugee has driven her to realize her dream to help you to become the best that you can be. So join Quinn every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time, for an hour of insight and inspiration for your heart, your spirit, and your soul. Good evening. This is Quinn's Empowerment Hour with Quinn Lay Erickson. Thank you for joining me tonight. Tonight, I'm hoping to address a topic that I think is very applicable, relevant to many, many people. Nowadays, I'm hoping to address mental illness in this show. And I'm very pleased to be able to invite a guest to the show tonight. Her name is Suzanne Vanuta. And she will share with us her lived experience as someone diagnosed with a mental disorder called dissociative identity disorder, we're going to call it DID. And this mental disorder was formerly known as multiple personality disorder. So let me tell you a little bit about Suzanne Vanuta. Suzanne is a mental health educator, advocate, and inspirational speaker. As a person with lived experience, Suzanne understands all too well the stigma and the misconceptions around mental illness. This is why she frequently presents to the public and professionals alike. She believes that by creating a safe space to have open and respectful dialogue, all of us can gain a deeper understanding of mental illness and in turn support each other. Besides her presentations and discussions, Suzanne hosted a piece on living with dissociative identity disorder that aired on CBC Radio Outfront program in 2008. She has authored an article in the Insights into Clinical Counseling magazine published by the BC Association of Clinical Counselors in 2012. She also writes two blogs about mental illness, which can be found at http://hopeandmentalhealth.blogspot.ca and http://suzy.livingsuccessfullywithdid.blogspot.ca. So, without any further ado, here is Suzanne Vanuta.
Hi, Suzy. Thanks for coming in today, onto my show today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. It's an honor to be able to do this.
So, Suzy, you have been diagnosed with a disorder called dissociative identity disorder, which is formerly known as multiple personality disorder. Can you tell us sort of how that diagnosis got started?
Yes, unfortunately, it had been called multiple personality disorder, so there's a lot of misconceptions around it and a lot of fear. I was diagnosed with complex post-traumatic stress disorder in 1998, and I started going to the local hospital here. They have a phenomenal program called Adult Day Therapy Program, and it's a lot of educational workshops they had, and they would have it on a weekly basis, and so I went through there to help deal with basically my anxiety at the time, because life was pretty stressful. And then they informed me that there was a psychiatrist in town who had a support group for, yeah, I call it a support group, for people who had complex PTSD, and would I be interested? I said, yeah, sure. So I went and saw the psychiatrist and started working with him and joined the group. And it was there that he started noticing certain traits. And so as we started working together, we started working on how my past issues were affecting my present. And then he noticed that even in the group work I was doing, I would be dissociating and disconnecting, and he would see what they call switching. And normally, switching basically looks like mood changes, rapid mood changes. And so he brought that to my attention, and then I looked into it, and then he said, there's a whole screening process that you need to go through to be diagnosed with this. You just can't say, oh, you are DID. There's a whole screening process you've got to go through. So I did the screening process and did the tests and got the results back. And, I was diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder. And at first I thank goodness I'm not crazy. And then I thought, holy crap, I must be crazy, because the only awareness I had of it was what was on, you know, media, TV, movies, and stuff like that. So I did a lot of research because I wanted to make sure my psychiatrist knew what he was talking about, and I needed to get a handle on it. And it was a new beginning.
So that was, I believe, in 2003, right?
In 2003, yeah.
Susie, for those of us who might not be familiar with this disorder, can you tell us what might that look like for a person being diagnosed with this disorder?
For me, it was a godsend for me to be diagnosed. And I did a radio piece for CBC Radio, the Out Front program, in 2008. And I started interviewing friends and my family doctor about what they saw and what it was like for them. And it was quite interesting because I didn't realize my, like they call it, switching was as obvious as it was. I have a best friend, and she said to me, she said, well, I was over visiting your place, and we were transplanting, working in the garden. And she said, I came over and you made muffins and tea, and I have no memory of this. And that's one of the big issues for me with DID is memory issues. And she said, and we were outside and we're working and we're planting stuff, and she said, and all of a sudden you said, I got to get something to eat, and I need to eat it now. And she said, and it was in this really deep, gruff voice. And she thought, okay, let's go for lunch. So we said, apparently, I said, that's a good idea. And I sort of huffed off around the side of the house. I came around the other side of the house, and she's washing the tools and washing her hands. And apparently, as if nothing happened, in a quite different voice, well, okay, what are we going to do now? So that's one example of what it looks like. Another example is I have people come up and talk to me, not so much now, but in the early days, and I would have no idea who they were. But they obviously knew who I was, right, because they had obviously talked to me. One example was I was at a grocery store, and I'm talking to this woman in line, and I'm thinking, trying to figure out who she is, because she's asking me about my family daycare, and, you know, and I'm trying to go through my brain, like, what group do I know her from, trying to figure out where I know her from. And then the cashier said, oh, sorry about the line, you know, the wait in the lineup. And the woman who I was talking to said, oh, it's okay, I don't get to talk to my neighbor very often.
So yeah, so you don't remember.
I didn't even recognize her, right? So it's like, oh, okay. So yeah, a lot of, it will look like a lot of people, I will do stuff and not remember doing it. And of course, this happened, you know, when I was a kid all the time. So I just learned to quit saying I didn't do that, because people would say, you're lying. I just, you know, would say then, well, I forgot, right?
So I would imagine probably lots of anxiety.
It was a lot of anxiety and energy, you know, especially anxiety, like, you know, when I'd go in an episode and, you know, they could last for, you know, a couple hours, and I call it come to, and I'd have no idea where I was, right? I'd have no idea how I got there. You know, I have no idea where I was. Yeah, it was a little, and then of course, once that anxiety starts, right, you're always on alert for it. And so that would increase the anxiety. And it was, and the switching usually was always caused by a trigger. And even if it was good stress, right, the body doesn't know any difference, right, between good stress and bad stress. It's still stress as far as the body's concerned. And so whenever I would start to get anxious, I would switch, and it could be even a good thing. Like a friend and I co-produced a play here for Rainbow Youth Theater way back, and we had an adult cast party, and we went downstairs, and there's people playing the drum, playing a guitar and singing, and there's a drum set there. And I thought, oh, this is kind of neat, have a jam. I haven't sat in the drum set for years. And I went and sat down, and we're playing away. I'm thinking, why? And they're getting ready to stop. And I'm thinking, why are you quitting? We've only been playing 3 songs. And then I look at my watch and realize we've been playing 3.5 hours. Because when I sat down on that drum set, I switched. And when they finished, I came back to, they call it apparent normal self. And I still have no memory of those 3.5 hours.
So lots of memory lapses.
Huge memory losses. Once I was diagnosed, I finally started connecting the dots and realizing this is why I can't remember birthdays. This is why I can't remember Christmases. This is why I can't remember years of my life. It's not just, you know, and people say, well, I always forget stuff. Do you forget years of your life, right?
So do you find, Susie, that since the diagnosis, since you become more aware, and I would imagine receiving more therapy, has that helped in terms of the anxiety and the lapses in the memory?
It's been amazing. It's been a godsend. When I was diagnosed, like I said, I could finally start to understand what was going on. And I'm not dumb, and I'm not stupid, and I'm not crazy. Because when you're in this, you think, A, everybody has memory gaps like this. But when you realize they don't have memory gaps, you just think I just thought I was dumb and stupid and crazy. School was a nightmare. So yeah, therapy was really hard. But of all the psychiatric conditions, DID is one of the best. You come out best with the therapy, right? It actually really, really does work. It can make a difference. I now have linear memory, which I didn't have before. I can remember going, you know, having a cup of coffee with my son or going for a walk. I went to Tofino for 4 days last week with my best friend. I can remember those 4 days, whereas one time I wouldn't remember that.
So are you saying then the switching doesn't happen as often now?
It rarely happens. Yeah. And I explained it to somebody, like, when I was first diagnosed, my switching would be like, I would find myself triggered, but I wouldn't know I was triggered. And it would be like weeks before I realized that I had switched. And then as therapy came along and he started working on what the issues were, well, first was, you know, the safety. You got to do the safety and make sure you have all the skills for safety and grounding, so when you get triggered and stuff. And then as time went by, I would get triggered just as often, but I would become more aware of it. I wouldn't necessarily dissociate as much. And as time went on, yeah, I very rarely dissociate now. And when I do start to disconnect, I can feel the physical changes in my body. Like, my ears will start ringing, my vision will start to get blurry. So I have these signs, kind of like a person who has a migraine, right? And you've got these auras and signs before you're going to get the migraine. So now I have these signs. I notice these signs now, so I can do what I need to do so I don't dissociate. So, and yeah, it's much, much less. It's when I'm really stressed and I haven't switched in, oh, I've got to say, a couple of years now.
That must be a huge relief for you.
It is amazing. It's yeah, because I've worked so hard with the therapy, and I've been very fortunate with skillful, I have phenomenal psychiatrists and phenomenal therapists who have helped me with this, and an amazing family doctor. Because when I first told him I was diagnosed with DID, he didn't know what it was, but he was open-minded enough to learn what he could, you know. And now he tells his, we have a residence program here for doctors, and he tells them, he says, call it what you want, right? Think of it as extreme PTSD. You know, this is what happened to her. This is how she dealt with it, and this is how it's affecting her life now. Yeah, so I've had a lot of good help, and life is so much richer now. You know, I have actual connections now, deep interpersonal connections with my friends and my family and my son, my husband. Whereas before, they couldn't be as deep because there was always this, it was like there was this wall between me and them. And it wasn't, you know, even though it was safe, internally, I didn't feel it was safe to have that deep connection because of my past history as a kid. So many times you would trust because you have to trust the caregiver. And that trust became, you know, nasty stuff would happen. So you just learn to put this wall up or disconnect. And that was great when I was a kid, and that's how I survived. But it became my, my internal knee-jerk reaction. That's what I did all the time. And so that's when it became, a disorder. But now with the therapy, life is so much richer, and I can feel so much deeper connections and just so much happier, more content. Yeah, a lot of gratitude.
I'm just curious with the DID, for as long as you remember, how young do you think when it started?
It started with me. I can remember being two and a half and disconnecting. It's free. The studies say DID is created before the age of seven, some say eight. And it's a way for a child to deal with overwhelming circumstances and carry on like nothing has happened. Very often it's if you're in an abusive environment. Also, if what they're starting to learn now is little ones that have had multiple medical procedures do have a tendency to have a higher rate of DID, and children that have lived in refugee camps and been in a civil war because they can't escape it, right? And that's what it's all about, is trying to escape something they have no control over, and they have a tendency to have a higher percentage of DID, but it's created before the age of seven, some say eight. Studies, may do a year different, but, between their studies. But, yeah, and it's, so you can't not have it and then all of a sudden have it as an adult. And that's one of the things they do with the screening, right, is have you had, how long have you had this? And they try to get some sort of idea of how long this has been going on. But for me, yeah, I remember being two and just totally disconnecting.
So what you're saying is DID would have to start at a young age, very young age.
Yep.
And you're saying the benefits is to be able to escape psychologically so that the child can handle very difficult circumstances.
Yes. Yeah, because, a kid's got nowhere to go, right? They can't jump in the car and run away from it, especially when it's a caregiver who is the one who's causing the trauma, because you got... as adults, we sit there and we think, well, we know somebody really well, like a friend or something, and then we find out they've done something horrific. And we try to wrap our heads around that and go, well, that's not the person I know. I don't understand this. Why didn't I see this? And all these sort of things. But this is, as an adult, we can try to figure this out. A little kid doesn't have the complexities or the understanding. And so if you've got a caregiver, like I did in my case, and this is the person that you are depending upon for your survival, it's like, oh, this is the good caregiver. Oh, okay. And then this is the bad caregiver. Well, the good caregiver feeds and clothes me, and the bad caregiver is not very nice. But it's the same person, so the poor little brain just can't deal with it. But yeah, it's developed before, during childhood, and it's a way to escape where you can't, right? You escape in your mind.
With the ID, we hear about different alters. Right. Mm-hmm. What's your sense about how many alters were there or are there within you?
I remember working on that and came to about at least 17. And it's not that there's 17 different me's. Like, everybody has different aspects of themselves, and there's... You go to work, you're who you are, you're different when you're around friends, you're different when you're around your boss, you're different when you're at the party with somebody else. So each group, we all have different aspects, we all act a little differently around the environment and who we're in. And people with DID, it's not that they have like a million different personas or alters, it's that they don't have one cohesive one. Because in childhood is when you start to develop yourself around two and a half years of age. You'll see a toddler, right, and they start to discover who they are and where they are within, represent themselves within the world and within their family. And it's around that age that you start to become who you are. You start to develop yourself. But kids who are in these circumstances don't get to develop themselves. So it's not like I have a million different personalities. It's that I didn't have one cohesive one. But each persona was like a different aspect of me. There would be like the writer, and I would write, and I'd go to bed, and I'd get up the next morning, and I'd totally have no memory of writing the night before. and that may last 6 months, and then I come across them and go, oh, gee, I don't remember writing that. There's another one, we call her Hazel, lovingly, which is a very protective, and all these aspects are kid logic, right? They're not, because they're developed in a childlike state, and the small kids, they don't have the complexities to think like an adult. Like little kids, especially young ones, if you knock over their blocks, they'll be mad, but they can't be sad and mad at the same time until they're older. And so all these my personas are like one dimension. So there's Hazel, and Hazel was a lovely protector, but very explosive. And then there is, I call him Stanley, and Stanley is 12 years old, and he was came about when one of my brothers, who was a protector, helped protect me, joined the military, joined the army. So when he joined, when he was 16, he was out of the house, so I had to develop another one to help me when shit hit the fan, right, when stuff started happening, because when stuff started happening before, my brother would find small places for me to hide in. When he was gone, I developed another persona to help me do that. So yeah, there's about 17. Some were fully developed, could fully function. Others are just aspects of, you know, some of the theories back in the 80s was that, you know, they call it integration. You would have to get rid of these alters, and I'm like, no, I don't think so. They're all part of me, right? They're all part of my aspects of who I am. So, and it was like each one had a wall between each one. Nobody necessarily knew what the other one was doing.
So let me see if I can get this. So for people who have different parts of their identity, is it kind of like different branches, but they all connected to a tree?
Yes, and they all remember, like if you go to work and then you go play baseball afterwards, after work, when you go to bed at night, you remember what your day was like. There is a connection. There's a linear connection there.
There's a right? core person in there.
Yep, and so those memories are there, right? In my case, there wasn't a core persona, and there was no linear memory.
Kind of like these branches being chopped up and no tree attached to them, and so they're being scattered over the place. Is it kind of like that? So now, what's that like now? Like those altars, do you have awareness of them now?
Oh yeah, it's wonderful. I can sit down and write, go make a cup of tea and go back to writing. You know, or I can sit, like I can start my blog and start writing it and think, okay, now I'm kind of stuck, but it's not quite working, so I need a bit of a break. You know, and go do something and come back to it the next day.
So what has helped you to get to that stage?
A lot of therapy and becoming aware of these different aspects of myself, right? Understanding what their job was, because they all had jobs to do, and learning all these aspects of who I am. So it's kind of like, you know, you've got an onion and you're peeling it away. And so I'd get to know a part of me or a persona or an aspect of myself. And then the next layer would be peeled away. And then I find, you know, I need to deal with this one. And that came along through the trauma work and the trauma therapy. It was like a very, very big onion with lots of layers. And when I, you know, was in a safe space and knew that this is what I needed to do, this is what I needed to work on, and a lot of trauma therapy and openness and, you know, learning the skills of not disconnecting, not dissociating, and all that sort of stuff. And then, and then it just sort of happens. They call it integration. I don't know what, you know, another name for it, but
It's kind of like putting the branches somehow, trying to put them back.
It's, you know, when I talk to the kids in the high schools, I say to them, it's kind of like a lotus flower. If you can visualize a lotus flower and it has its center core, and then it opens up and it has all these petals. Well, all these petals are aspects of who I am, but at that time there was no core, there was nothing for it attached to. And once I started to understand who I was And what was going on is like the petals have reattached themselves to the lotus flower. So now there's the core and all my aspects.
And it's
But,
beautiful too.
oh, thank you. It is a lovely, I love
Actually,
lotus
I haven't
flowers.
touched the lotus flower myself yet, but I would.
Oh,
I think that's a great symbol. Much much nicer than the tree analogy.
Tree's good too.
So, Susie, can you share with us what are some social challenges or myths about DID? Because you know we know a lot about depression. We even know a little bit about bipolar. Right? People have an idea. But depression, anxiety, sort of those disorders are a lot more well recognized and accepted in our society nowadays. With DID, well, first of all, what's the percentage of DID, and what might be some myths and challenges for you?
On some readings I've done, some studies say 1 to 3% of the general population has DID, up to 10% of incarcerated populations has this disorder. And I think one of the biggest challenges around the stigma is fear. You tell people, you say, what's a dissociative identity disorder? And we automatically say, well, they used to call it multiple personality disorder. And I've seen people's faces, right? And I totally understand it too, because I was there before I was diagnosed, right? When I was first diagnosed, my understanding was the same as their understanding. It was all whatever the media showed, right? It was, whatever the newscast said or whatever the movies, right? And I'm going old school now, like Sybil and the Three Faces of Eve. But even, the United States of Terror, right? I watched the first couple episodes of that and I'm like going, really? It's not that, I shouldn't say it's not that extreme. Not everybody who has DID has the extreme switching and personalities.
And the movie that I can remember is called Identity in 2003.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one
yet.
Yeah,
that's a psychological thriller and it's pretty scary. Yeah,
because you got the good guy and the bad guy, right? You got the nice person and then you got the other one that's going to go.
Well, there were like nine of them, actually, 9 or 10 of them in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but yeah, so associated with a lot of dramas in the movie of Identity, sort of scariness, right? Because they do horrific things.
Yes.
What else, Susie?
Well, I think part of the thing with Hollywood is I have a really good friend, and he said, when you switch, it's like a wave has gone across your face. Well, it's very slight. But Hollywood can't portray that, right? You can't make somebody do that, and it can't show up on the camera, so it's all the dramatic stuff. The biggest myth is the good guy and the bad guy, right? The Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and people not understanding, right? And, like even in the media and the news, right, if somebody does a horrific act and they have a mental illness, that's the first thing they point out, right? But they don't say, oh, this guy also collected stamps, or, this guy was also the other stuff he did. And this is what really irritates me about the media is the sensationalism. And I've watched talk shows who've had people on who have DID, and I'm thinking, oh, yes, finally we can get some good education here, right? But it's not. It's all sensationalized stuff. And I'm going, and I get really upset because I think this is an amazing opportunity to educate people about the creativeness and the amazing thing that kids can do to overcome overwhelming circumstances. And they get them on stage and say, oh, switch alters. That's not what it's about. It's about a very creative way to deal with horrific circumstances that nobody should have to go through. And I think here's a really good educational opportunity, and they sensationalize it, right? And millions of people are watching this, and I'm just like, oh, I feel like this fish going upstream the wrong way, right? Like,
yeah.
it's not like that.
And what about actual emotional challenges in your life at the time?
Feeling any emotion was an emotional challenge.
So feeling numb?
I was absolutely numb, right? I tell people, I say dissociation was my drug of choice, because while it helped me not feel when the horrific stuff was happening to me, it also stopped me from feeling the good stuff in life, right? I remember when I had some surgery quite a few years back, and I had a pain pump. And I remember coming out of the surgery, and I felt absolutely numb, right? I felt no pain, nothing, but I didn't feel any emotional connection to the people that came to visit me, right? And I thought, wow, this is what it used to be like. I would feel absolutely nothing, you know? And if I did feel some emotional connection, it was a part of me that felt a connection. It wasn't my whole, they call it apparent normal self, who the core of me couldn't feel that because it was too scary. It was, you know, because past history said this is not a good thing, right? So feeling any emotional thing was absolutely terrifying. You know, I laugh at it now. I think back, like in 2005, I fractured my ankle really badly. I've got a plate and 7 pins in it. And it's all good now, but I remember I needed surgery on it and coming home and having to depend on my husband, right? Because people who experienced trauma, severe trauma like mine, we do have a tendency to want to do everything for ourselves because the world has shown us that we can ask to help for nobody. There's nobody but us, and this is how we got to do it. And we put our blinders on, and we get through it. And I remember, yeah, it was really, I remember having to go to therapy, you know, talk to my therapist about, oh my God, you know, I have to depend, as silly as it sounds, I have to depend on my husband, right? But that was actually terrifying because there's no walls and this is what you got to do. So feeling anything, fear was easier to handle than really deep connections.
Vulnerability, that's a huge, was hard.
Oh, huge vulnerability. Yeah, because, you know, past, right? And people say, well, how come, you know, when I say to them, the body remembers, and they say, well, that doesn't make any sense. You're not there. This happened like, you know, 50 years ago plus. And I say, yeah, well, you've heard of phantom limb syndrome, right? Just because the limb's not there doesn't mean the person doesn't feel it, right? It's the brain remembers. So, and it's very often I felt like this internal battle going on when I was going through therapy because, you know, I knew I needed to do this work, but another part of me is going, no, you don't. We can't do that. It's not safe. Yeah, so being, getting the walls down and sitting and feeling vulnerable, feeling love, feeling fear, all those things without disconnecting, without dissociating, because they would be a huge trigger for me, right? So, yeah, that was one of the biggest challenges.
And so I would imagine, like you said earlier, having deep, meaningful connections at a time was a challenge.
It was, and it's amazing. And when it first happened, back to my therapist I go, right?
Yeah. and so, like, did people think that you lied as well?
They did, yeah.
Yeah.
I think back in high school, you know, where somebody said you were somewhere, I saw you at lunchtime, and
right.
and you know, I waved to you, and you didn't wave to me, and I said, I wasn't there, and they go, yes, you were. I'm going, oh, okay, sorry, I guess I didn't, you yeah, know, I guess uh-huh. I didn't see it. I'm really good at BSing stuff, right, because I've had
yes.
so many years of practice,
right.
You know, when somebody coming up to me and talk to me, and I have no idea who they are, you know, I'm like, oh, hi, how's everyone doing? I'm trying to get some...
Yeah,
hoping something.
Well, it's kind of like, actually, in some way, it's kind of like me, because sometimes, not quite, but sometimes when people tell me who they are, and then later on, I don't remember their voices, right? And so
yeah.
when it's just say hi and hello, and I'm trying to talk to get them to talk more.
Yep, please throw me a bone.
And so yeah, but now I just have, you know, I'm sorry, so I don't remember who you are. Can you tell me again?
Yeah,
but
yep.
and it could be a client too, so I can kind of connect to
mm-hmm.
that point.
Yep. Yeah, I have learned that, you know, honesty is the best policy now, you know. Yeah, it's, yeah, they would tell me I lied to them, or there's always arguments, and, you know, it's yeah, and it doesn't just affect me, right? As with any mental illness, it affects the people I care about, it affects my family. You know, I remember when I did the interview, I interviewed my son, and he said, Mom, when I turned 16, you disappeared. And what he meant was I didn't physically disappear, but the mom persona disappeared. You know, and he said to me, he says, I felt like you lied to me all the time, because you would say we'd go to the beach, or you'd help me with my homework, or we'd do this, right? And it never happened, right? He realizes now it's because I had switched, right? whoever said that we were going to do it, I'd switch it and have no memory of it. But yeah, it's hard on him, it's hard on the family and the people I care about.
It sounds like you have really come a long way. Can you tell us sort of what's been like for you in the last 13 years? I understand that you do all kinds of presentations with all kinds of different populations. Tell us more about that, Susie.
Yeah, it's I'd never believe, you know, if you asked me 13 years ago, you know, I'd never believe I'd be doing what I'm doing now. I did the piece for CBC Radio in 2008, mainly because I was really angry at the myths and you know, people's ideas of what this condition was. Yeah, so I did the CBC piece, and then I talked to some psychology students and at North Island College, and then I have met with some of my doctor's medical students. I've had coffee with them to talk to them about what it's like, and whenever he gets a medical student or a resident student, he always sends them in to talk to me. And now I've been talking to high school kids on DID and mental illness, and another group I did on resiliency, and I've this past year, well, September and just last month, I've talked to teachers on their Pro-D Day about how to connect with kids with mental health challenges. And yeah, so it's I'd love to do a TED talk someday. That's on my bucket list. Uh-huh. And yeah, I so want to do that. And yeah, it just sort of doors are sort of starting to open up with this public speaking. And it's I remember when I first started, I thought, oh my God, I got to get all the stats, I got to do all the research. And then I remembered, no, it's already out there, right? This is my story, and especially with the youth, right? I remember being that age, and it was horrific. And it's a struggle, and I didn't have social media, right? So there's a lot of challenges that they're facing nowadays. And yeah, so it just kind of goes, and I've written, you know, an article, and I've got two blogs going, and everybody who is in my social circle knows I have this condition. I have lost a couple friends over it, but I've come to realize that's their issue and not mine. And I've captained my Dragon Boat team 3 times. They all know about it. People at my ringette team knows about it. People I golf with, they all know about it. It's not a secret. And that's part of the reason I do the talking and the education, is because I've got nothing to lose, right? I'm on disability. I can't lose my job, right? What are they going to say? Oh, she's crazy? Fine. That's, you know, I've got nothing to lose. Where I know people who have mental health challenges and are absolutely terrified of anybody finding out. Because of the stigma and misunderstanding around it.
And what has been people's response?
Phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Nothing but positive stuff. Nothing but positive. Like when I talked to the psychology teacher's class up at Highland Secondary here in Comox, what she does is get the kids to write comments to me, mm-hmm. on separate pieces of paper so nobody reads anybody else's comments, and then she mails them to me. And it's absolutely phenomenal.
What did they say?
Oh, you know, they say stuff. It could be like things like, you know, I was kind of scared when you were coming in to talk about the ID.
Yeah.
Which is honest, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Total, you know, honest and understandable.
Did they know what the ID was initially?
They didn't know what it was initially. And it was just, you know, their perception was, you know, the media and the teacher, Jill Peacock, does an awesome job teaching them about it. And they always have really good questions. So there's comments like, you know, I was kind of scared, and I think good for you for telling me that and being almost open and honest about it. Could be things like, you've shown me that, you know, your life has been crap, but you've gotten through it, and so I can get through my life that's crap.
Wow. Uh-huh.
You know, to lots of, yeah, apparently I make an impact. You know, and I just sort of shrug my shoulders and go, well, it's kind of good, you know, it's awesome. And it's just amazing feedback, right? And talking to these kids, some of them come up and talk to me afterwards, and sometimes it's the first time they've actually talked to anybody about a mental health challenge, whether it's them or a friend or a family. It's just, yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, I got one note from one young student in, well, grade 12. She's going into nursing, but now she's going into psychiatric nursing. You know, yeah, nothing but positive stuff.
Well, I'm really glad that has happened for you.
And, yeah, me too.
Yeah, so what, I don't know, what does it mean to you now, Susie, having DID?
I remember one of the kids at the school asked me, are you glad you have it? Right? And I thought, good question. And I thought about it, and I said, some ways I am, because it, well, in a lot of ways I am, because it did help me survive, right? It ultimately helped me survive, and that's what it was about. Did I enjoy the struggle? No. You know, there's a lot of things that I can't do. You know, like a lot of my past has been lost that I won't be able to take back, right? Dreams and things I wanted to do when I was younger, but, you know, that's not a possibility anymore. But it did help me survive, right? It did. And ultimately, DID protected the core me of who I was, right? I think of it and I tell them, I say, everybody is born with an essence, right? Whenever you're born, you are born with an essence. And it is always in you, and it will always be carried around with you. And if you're born in a good enough family, your parents don't have to be perfect. If you're born in a good enough family, they will see the specialness and the uniqueness and the talents that you have, and they will help you to embrace that. If you grew up in a family with, like I did, or in a situation where it's not safe to show who you really, really are, that gets tucked inside and protected. And this is what the DID did for me, right? It's like a protected and inside, and all these layers upon layers upon layers were surrounded. It surrounded and protected, kind of think like a diamond, right? In this really large lump of coal. And, you know, and I say to them, with this essence, no matter how crappy life is, no matter how much shit's thrown at you, and no matter how many times people say, well, you know, I got angry and I hit you because it's your fault or any of that stuff, right? I said, it's all about them. It's not about you. I said, but when you get in an environment and you get old enough and you get in a place where it's safe enough and it's okay to be who you are, I said, that shell's going to start cracking away and that brilliance is going to start shining and nobody can take it away from you. And this is what DID did. It survived. It helped me survive and protect the core self of who I am, right? It protected my sense of humor. It helped with my resiliency. And this is what I'm discovering now, right? With this, they call it integration, I guess, right? This is who I am. I am finally starting to understand and realize who I am. Right, my light's starting to shine, and it's like friggin' amazing. It's, yeah, there's no way I could have thought I'd ever be where I am now, you know, 13, 20 years ago, right? It was survival mode, right? It's just phenomenal. It's just amazing.
It sounds to me the growth has been exponential for you.
It has been, yeah. It's wonderful, you know, like I can stop and look at a dewdrop on a flower, right, and see it shining and just think, wow, this is pretty cool, you know, because I'm not in survival mode anymore, right? And when you're in survival mode, it's like you have the blinders on and you will get through it, but you don't notice anything else around you. And survival mode can be a disorder too. I remember when I fractured my ankle and I said to my friend, I said, man, they're giving me T3s, but it's just not working, right? Coming all threes for my pain. And he looked at me and he said, you know, you can ask for something else. Well, I didn't even think of that because I was in survival mode. I had the blinders on. I'm going to get through this, right? And I thought, wow, what an epiphany. You know, like I can ask for something else, right? But that wasn't an option. Now if, you know, something like that happens, if something's not working, I can say, okay, need something else. This isn't working right. And I can advocate for myself. I can advocate for my son. In a much more healthier way, instead of, you know, Hazel coming out and blowing up and calling people nasty names.
What's your message to people with mental health issues or mental health disorder?
Never give up. Never, never, ever give up, right? It's a temporary life. Life is, there's nothing permanent in life, the good or the bad, right? The sun comes up and the sun goes down. Things are always changing. You have the resiliency. We are all here on this planet because our ancestors carried on, right? Everybody is on this planet right now because our ancestors carried on, and we have that resiliency within us, right? And you're not alone, right? Especially youth. You are not alone. You know, and I tell the youth, you know, if you have a mental health challenge, you're part of the 1.3 million youth in this country. You belong to a big group. You're not by yourself. It's okay to ask for help. And that's one of the scariest things, is actually asking for help, because once you ask for help, then that's acknowledging you have an issue. But it's okay. There's phenomenal support out there. Like I said, everybody I golf with, everybody I play ringette with, everybody I dragon boat with, they all know about my issue and they still love and support me the best that they can. Now, some people will be able to support you the way you want, and some for whatever reason won't be able to, but that doesn't mean they're not caring, right?
Yeah, they just don't know how.
They just don't know how. And I had a crisis this time last year, well, February, March of last year. I couldn't get into the hospital, so my therapist and I worked together, and I sent out a support plan to my Ringette team. And that was as much and as far as I had gone in therapy. That scared me, right? Because that's not just asking a few intimate people. That's asking my entire team. They were phenomenal. They're absolutely amazing. Some came to visit me every day. I had a friend that phoned me 4 times a day, checking in with me. People that couldn't get off work or couldn't physically come here were text messaging me. It was amazing. It was, but in the support plan, I let them know what they could do for me, and this is what I needed. And it just blew me away. It still does. So yeah, don't ever give up. There's people out there that want to help, and you may get some turkeys, right? That's putting it bluntly. I've had a real turkey when I was in Saskatchewan, right? Mm-hmm. But don't give up, you know. Keep
and
going
you know,
forward.
And when people help you, you actually give them a very important gift, right? Being able to be empathetic and compassionate and doing something for another person.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, it's amazing. It's a full circle, right?
And yet, I think, Susie, I think what started that chain of reaction, I would imagine, was your courage to take the first step.
Yeah, my psychiatrist, remember, he said to me, he says, you have this tenacity, like you're like a terrier with a bone. Mm. And I said to him, is that a good thing? You know, and he said, yes, because growing up, I was stubborn, right? And stubborn was always a negative thing, right? And I remember reading somewhere, the difference between stubbornness and tenacity is stubbornness is I won't, tenacity is I will. You know, yeah, so it had gotten to a point in my life where, you know, every once in a while you come to a crossroads, and I had, you know, I couldn't work anymore. We lost the house. We lost our credit. We lost everything. I thought I was going crazy, and I thought, okay, something's not working here, right? And I remember being in the parking lot, right, to the psychiatrist's office, my first visit with him, and I'm thinking, oh, I could just go for coffee now, right? But I knew if I went for coffee, I'd still have the problems, you know. So yeah, it was scary, but I'm glad I did it, you know.
Thank you so much, Susie. That was a very inspiring story, and thank you so much for sharing with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for the opportunity. It's really appreciated.
No, I really appreciate, you know, you being very authentic and very honest. And I could imagine, you know, the kids that you go and speak with, it would really mean a lot to them.
Yeah, it's the feedback's always been good. And I get something out of it, too, right? You know, I learn more and more. And even the teacher said, when you first did the first presentation 5 years ago, you had to be out in the hallway while they changed classes, and there's like, they have a 10 minutes, like a homeroom class where they get announcements and stuff. You just needed quiet out there before you came and did the presentation. She says, now you just come in and sit here with the 10 minutes with their homeroom class. And, you know, so it's helped me evolve too.
Yeah. So the first presentation, do you remember a lot of fear?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was like, what the hell am I doing?
Right.
And, you know, and I had made my notes, and, you know, so, and I didn't do PowerPoint. I still don't do PowerPoint. I'm so dyslexic. That would just be an absolute nightmare. And
it's a good thing. You know, I think it's a lot more interactive. You sort of encourage people to listen more.
Yeah. And yeah, it is. Because I remember going to presentations and going, oh my God, any more PowerPoints?
PowerPoint doesn't go well with blind people either. So
yeah, you know, and for some people that's fine, but that's not who I am. And that's what I've learned through this process is my authentic self, and this is who I am, and this is what I can give you. And but my first presentation was like, oh yeah, I don't think I slept the night before.
Right.
Oh yeah, it was like, okay, got to do this. Yeah,
yeah. And yet, with anything, right? With practice, it's always become much better and better and better, and become a master of it.
It is, yeah. You know, now I just take a few notes with me, and I just kind of wing it. And you know, I you know, let the kids go where they want to go with
Can
it.
Can you tell me you've just done a 6-hour workshop or something?
I did a full day PD, Pro Development Day. So for the teachers, about connecting with kids with mental health challenges. So it was 9 until, I think, 12, and then we had an hour lunch. But, you know, they're talking to me during the breaks, and which is fine, right? And they're talking to me during the lunch hour, which is also fine. And then I had another person came and joined me, Colleen from the Force, which is for families and with children with mental health challenges. And they're a phenomenal organization. And so she came, so I co-facilitated with her with that until 2:30. So I guess it was about 5 hours. So I did learn something from that, is at lunchtime, I'm leaving. You know, yeah. As much as I enjoyed talking to them, which is really good, but I need a break, right? But it was a really good conversation.
I think it's really amazing, Susie, because it really speaks to the fear of success, right? Because when you come out and be true to yourself and who you are, in some way there are more expectations, because you can't just go into your shell and shut down and numb out anymore, right? You have to be out there connecting, presenting, talking.
Yes. And I'm a sociable introvert, right? I like connecting, but I also need my downtime, right? So it's you're on the, and it does make it a little harder, because there's no script, there's no PowerPoint or anything. I never know where it's going to go. But I love the challenge. I really do love the challenge of doing that, because it makes me think on my feet. And I mean, there'll be stuff coming out of my mouth. I go, oh wow, you know, like, here you go again, Susie. You got the knowledge, right? They say you have to have 10,000 hours to be an expert. Well, I think you got more than your 10,000 hours experience, right? So it's.
I really hope that you know, there are more people like you, so they can go out there, share the stories, educate, because I think that's the best way to increase awareness and education, is by sharing your own story.
Yeah, and it's, I think so, yeah, it's a good way to connect, and you're not this big, you know, Hollywood personality that people can't, I'm not going to say touch, but, you know, there's not this big wall between me and the rest of them, and there's a lot of people like me out there, right, that are doing this sort of thing. Yeah, it's great. It makes you, it's, I've discovered it does make a difference in people's lives, and it's obviously made a difference in mine too.
Well, thank you, Susie, and you have a great day.
You betcha. Thanks so much, Quinn. Very much appreciate it, hon.
No, it's okay. A pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, thanks, hon.
And that was Suzanne Vanuta speaking about her lived experience as someone diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder. To learn more about her blogs, to read about what she shares about her experience, go to the page of the show, so bbsradio.com/Quinn's Empowerment Hour. So bbsradio.com/Quinn's Empowerment Hour, or you can go to my webpage, which is quinle.com, so quinle.com. Thanks so much for joining me tonight, and I hope to speak to you soon in 2 Saturdays from now. You have a good night. Bye-bye.
This is Quinn's Empowerment Hour, hosted by Quinn Le Erickson, every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time. For more information about Quinn, visit www.quinle.com. Thank you so much for tuning in, and you have a beautiful, restful sleep. Good night.